If you would open up to Colossians chapter 2, Colossians chapter 2. Brent and I are going to take, beginning this month, we're going to talk about the sacrificial system. We're going to talk about the burnt offering, the grain offering, the sin offering, the trespass offering. Looking back at those offerings in the book of Leviticus so that we can really gain a focus of what the old covenant laid out, why it's worthwhile to study, seeing how Jesus is the fulfillment of all of those Old Testament sacrifices, and to really prepare us as we're going to start studying the book of Hebrews in October on Sunday mornings. So we're going to use the sacrificial system out of Leviticus, and we're definitely not going to cover the whole book of Leviticus. Don't think that in your mind. And you have to also understand why. So many times we look at Old Testament books, we go, why are we really here and what's the purpose? Now, if you open up to Colossians chapter 2, I want you to look down at verses 16 and 17 and to see some of these principles at hand. Colossians chapter 2, verses 16 and 17. It says, therefore, no one is to act as your judge in regard to food or drink or in respect to a festival or a new moon or a Sabbath day, things which are a mere shadow of what is to come, but the substance belongs to Christ. Under the old covenant, how much did people judge each other about food and the Sabbath? How many times did Jesus encounter people who thought he was really a blasphemer of God because of his activities on the Sabbath and because of clean and unclean foods? And you realize for us under the new covenant to look back and see what was the purpose of all these things. So whenever you look at verse 17, what did all these Old Testament principles really have to deal with? What were they? A shadow. Now, what does every shadow have to have? Something of substance, right? I mean, nothing doesn't cast a shadow. There has to be something. So, as you just look in these things about food and drink, and he brings up here festivals. In the Jewish thinking, you're talking about the Feast of Booths. You're thinking about in terms of the harvest, like Pentecost. You're thinking of the Passover. You're thinking of the Day of Atonement. All of those festivals, all those feasts, where all of Israel was to come together in Jerusalem. He goes on here, and you notice the point. He says there were even offerings that were specifically for new moons whenever they would come. So how often are they offered? Every month. Yes, no different than it is now, right? In terms of the moon cycles and times. He says, or a Sabbath day. And then if you look at verse 17, things which are a mere shadow of what is to come, but the substance belongs to Christ. Everything in that old covenant in terms of sacrifices was always to point out something about Jesus later on. Real quick example, the Sabbath. Sabbath was about rest. What does Jesus offer us in our spiritual lives because of what he's done? We find rest. And without him, we won't find a spiritual rest. Now, Old Covenant, what kind of rest was it about? Physical rest. So you see, New Covenant, really covering things in a much deeper fashion. And you realize, here's the substance. Anytime you see a shadow, you can always follow the shadow back till you get to something of substance. And that's exactly what these things are about. Look over at Hebrews chapter 8. Hebrews chapter 8, look at verse 1. We'll sum up all the first seven chapters of Hebrews in just a verse or two here. Hebrews chapter 8, verse 1 says, now the main point in what has been said is this. We have such a high priest who has taken his seat at the right hand of the throne of the majesty in the heavens. So what was the main point of the first seven chapters of Hebrews? We have a high priest. And where does he sit? He sits at the right hand of God. And specifically, who are we talking about? Jesus. So here he is. He sits as a high priest. And if you think about it, under the old covenant, how many high priests did you have at a time? One. And you go, there's only one. He says, he's taken his seat at the right hand of the throne of the majesty in the heavens. Then verse 2, a little bit more detail. A minister in the sanctuary and in the true tabernacle which the Lord pitched, not man. Now notice how he starts to use these terms. Sanctuary. How do people usually define sanctuary? A place of refuge, right? When you start talking about these things, you're talking about true tabernacle. Talking about a sanctuary. It literally is about, it's a place of holiness. And within the tabernacle in the Old Testament, until you came to the days of Solomon, then you get temple. And then now, in the first century with Jesus, you have the temple that was built by Herod, and of course, all of it was destroyed when? AD 70. So, we're already looking backwards. Then he says, all right, here's Jesus. He's a minister in the sanctuary, but not the one that's on earth. His is where? In heaven. And notice what he calls it. The true tabernacle. When you think of something saying, now this is the true tabernacle, what does it lead you to assume? There's not a false, is there a false one? But you realize really it goes back to the idea of shadow. The tabernacle that was on earth was a shadow of the true tabernacle in heaven. Now notice, who pitched the true tabernacle in heaven? The Lord did. Jesus is the one who pitched, and when you think about pitch, I hope you think in terms of tent, because that's the idea. So, he says, minister in the sanctuary, he says, the holy place within the true tabernacle. Now, he uses this word, sanctuary for a reason, a holy place within the true tabernacle that's in the heavens. And where is Jesus serving as high priest? Here he is at the right hand of God in the heaven, in heavens. Then he says, it was pitched. The Lord pitched it, not man. Was there one that man built? Yes. Give me some timing. When did that take place? When was the tabernacle built for the first time? All right. In the book of Exodus, you get Moses. God gives him instruction on parameters in terms of links of what it's supposed to be made of, all these things together to lay it out. And we'll see a little bit more of that here in a minute. But going, there's the shadow where these sacrifices are going to take place. And they're earthly things. He says, but there is something to see in terms of substance in Jesus. Now, he continues on, verse 3. He makes this comparison. For every high priest is appointed to offer both gifts and sacrifices. So it is necessary that this high priest also have something to offer. How many high priests does this affect? Every single one. Notice, what are the two things that they offer up? Gifts and sacrifices. Now you may look at those things and go, are those synonymous terms? Do those really mean the same thing? They do not. I want you to think about it in these terms. Gifts were things that were offered voluntarily. You were not commanded to offer them. It was something you did out of your own free will because you already had fellowship with God. Sacrifices, on the other hand, were because you had sinned or trespassed. And you needed to regain fellowship with God. So it came down to, do you care about this relationship with God or not? Because if you don't care, then are you going to offer them up? No. And are you going to have fellowship with God anymore? No. And so notice the terminology here. Gift was about burnt offering, grain offering, peace offering. They were all offerings that you would offer to God voluntarily because of sharing in this relationship, this fellowship with God. And the same thing, is it, you know, I always use this illustration. In the same sense of going, if you're enjoying a happy marriage in the Lord, can you celebrate? Can you say, hey, let's go out. Let's go out and get a meal. Let's go out and watch a movie. Let's go do something together. And you realize, do you do that to fix the relationship? If it's already going well, you're just celebrating this relationship. And gestures are being made. Here it is. He says, this is what every high priest is appointed to offer, both gifts and sacrifices. He says, so it's necessary that the high priest also have something to offer. So what is Jesus going to offer since he's high priest? Unless we're talking about gifts and sacrifices. So how does this fit together? Look at verse 4. Now, if he were on earth, he would not be a priest at all, since there are those who offer the gifts according to the law. If Jesus is on earth, would he even be a priest at all? No. Because what tribe is he born of? Judah. And what's the tribe that serves in the temple? It's even a specific group of people within the tribe of Levi. So it's like, we're not talking about earthly things anymore. You see how he's going through and making sure we understand that? We're not talking about how they handle things on earth. We're talking about how things are done in the very presence of God in heaven, in the true tabernacle, where Jesus now stands as the high priest. Then, notice what he continues on with. He's talking about these earthly priests. He says, who offer gifts, verse 5, who serve a copy and shadow of the heavenly things. He says, here's a copy and a shadow. If you have a copy, what do you have to have first? An original. Thanks to the Xerox people, we know about that pretty good. When you think in terms of, he says, a copy and a shadow. Now, are shadows always exact? No. When you think about, if here you are at 11 o'clock in the day and you stand outside and you look at your shadow, how tall does it make you look? I'm maybe just a couple, I'm shorter than a yard. But at the same time, if you get to later in the day, you know, as the sun's going down and you look at your shadow, how long is it then? You're like, man, I'm humongous. But you realize he's going to go through and talk about these things and say, here they are on earth serving a copy. It has to be an original first. And they're serving a shadow. And sometimes it's more exact than others. But looking at it and seeing, it's about the things that are the original and the true that are in heaven. So think about this for a second. They serve a copy and a shadow. Look at how we go forward from here in verse 5. He says, just as Moses was warned by God when he was about to erect the tabernacle, he was about to build it here in the wilderness. This quotation comes out of Exodus. He says, see, he says, that you make all things according to the pattern which was shown you on the mountain. He says, you've seen it. You've seen it with your eyes. He was able to get a picture of this pattern. He's also given the instruction from Moses. I mean, God to Moses about, here's how long I want these things to be. Here's what they're to be made of. I mean, things even so specific as certain aspects were to be made out of porpoise skin. And you go, that's very specific. And you start thinking, where are a bunch of people in the wilderness going to get porpoise skin? And if you remember, whenever they left Egypt, what all did they get to take with them? They plundered the place. They said, we'll give you whatever you want. Just get out of here. So you see the Lord prepare a people for this? He certainly did. Now, here's the real thing I want you to consider. It talks about that Moses was shown something genuine. They're building a copy and a shadow. So did the Lord pitch the true tabernacle before Exodus or after Exodus? Don't you have to have the original before you can make a copy? Try and do that at a Xerox machine, see how it turns out. I want the copy first. Not going to happen. Now, what you start to take note of, there are things that the Lord had already done before Jesus ever came to earth. This true tabernacle was already in place. God allowed in giving Moses the instruction and then the skill and the wisdom to be able to do this to where they could know what we're doing here is a copy and a shadow of the true tabernacle that's in heaven. If you have ever read through the New Testament and thought, you know, there's not very many passages about worship, about our worship together. If you start looking back at the book of Leviticus, you start to realize how much there really is about the true worship that's going on in heaven that we're getting to participate in terms of what Jesus did. Now, notice this next aspect of this. He says, verse 6, and now he, talking about Jesus, has obtained a more excellent ministry by as much as he is also the mediator of a better covenant, which has been enacted on better promises. Excellent ministry, better covenant, better promises. Is God limited by the old covenant? No. Because what is Jesus doing now in the true tabernacle? Better ministry, a more excellent ministry, better covenant, better promises. So, look back at the book of Leviticus. Leviticus chapter 1. Leviticus is a marvelous book. If you've just read at it in passing, you may not think so. But to understand what Leviticus is the copy in the shadows, showing you the things that should lead us to Jesus, because the substance is found in Christ. So, at the end of the book of Exodus, they have built the tabernacle. God himself has made his presence known. And if you notice the very beginning of Leviticus chapter 1, verse 1, what's the first word that you have in your translation? And then, words like this, does it make you feel like you're coming in the middle? I don't know if you ever had somebody start a conversation and go, then, what? I missed the first part of this.
Well, actually it is, and the.
And the. And you realize what you really have in Leviticus is volume 2 of Exodus. In the same way you probably think in New Testament wine of Luke and Acts, volume 1, volume 2, Leviticus could kind of be Exodus part 2. Because it follows through. All right, now this copy and shadow tabernacle has been built in the wilderness. What do we do here? And notice where he starts. Leviticus 1:1. Then the Lord called to Moses and spoke to him from the tent of meeting, saying, speak to the sons of Israel and say to them, when any man of you brings an offering to the Lord, you shall bring your offering of animals from the herd or the flock. Anybody have a footnote for offering? A Hebrew word? Korban. You remember a time in the New Testament where Jesus talks about Korban? Talks about the Pharisees say, you know what? This gift is Korban, so we've already dedicated it to God, so we can't use this to take care of my parents anymore. And Jesus says, why do you invalidate the word of God to support your own traditions? Korban is this word for offering. Now, he says, you've come to bring an offering to the Lord. He says, when you bring your offering of animals, he says, from the herd or the flock. Old Testament wise, whenever you see herd, think in terms of cows, oxen. When you see flock, think of what? Sheep and goats. So, he lays those things out here, verse 3. If his offering is a burnt offering from the herd, okay, a burnt offering, and this Hebrew word is where we get our English word for Holocaust. The idea is for it to be completely burned up. Now, it doesn't have the negative connotation back here that we think of with Holocaust, but that gives you the idea. He says, if his offering is a burnt offering from the herd, so you know we're dealing with a bull or an oxen, he says, he shall make it a male without defect. So our example that we're using here is basically a bull, a male. And then he says, without defect. Now, I know we have some livestock farmers in here. Tell me some defects that can come up in livestock. Scars. All right. Things can be frozen off in the winter. The extra body parts. You can have a limb that's longer than or shorter than the others. You can have an animal that can't see. All kinds of things. Diseases. You can go on and on about how many defects there are or could be. What do you notice about this animal that's going to be offered to God? It is without defect. Now, for any of you who have herds, what happens if you offer or eliminate the best bull out of your herd? What does it do to the whole in the years to come? Is it a sacrifice? It's something you will not get back in and of itself. Is it whether you're losing time or whatever? So is this really an offering to God? This is an offering that shows a continual offering, right? Taking, we would say, the best genetics and pulling them out of the pool. So, he says, he shall offer it, the male bull without defect, he shall offer it at the doorway of the tent of meeting, that he may be accepted before the Lord. So what if you take your offering somewhere else? It'll be unacceptable. So the Lord is telling Moses, this is what I want. I want a male without defect. Here they're using the idea of a bull. He says, and you have to bring it to the doorway of the tent of meeting. Now, the tent of meeting was a courtyard that also contained the holy place, the holy of holies, and a laver and an altar of burnt offering out front. And he says, you have to bring it here. How easy is it to lead around animals? It depends, doesn't it? You got one that's a little tame, they can be led around. You got one that's wild, is it really without defect? Here's a defect on the inside. Now, notice what comes next. He says, and it has to be here so it can be accepted. Verse 4. He shall lay his hand on the head of the burnt offering, that it may be accepted for him to make atonement on his behalf. He says he's going to lay his hand, here's the worshiper, coming to God, bringing the very best male bull that he has. And he says, and you're to take your hand and put it on the head of this animal. Now, what's going on here is, we've already had the presentation of the animal. I'm saying, I want this animal to take my place in this offering. And it's as if now, this animal will be treated like me. And I'm going to tell you how to treat it on the front end. Now, you start to think about that picture. And notice once again, he says, that it may be accepted for him to make atonement on his behalf. Notice there's a sliver idea here of atonement. But if you're going to approach God, what always has to be addressed? Sin. Now, this is not a sin offering. But just notice, that's part of the shadow here. Andrea, do you have a question? Amazing how that happens. Now, notice how it continues on here. He says that it may be acceptable for him to make atonement on his behalf. Verse 5. What's the next thing he's going to do with this bull? Slay it. Now, remember, who does this bull stand for? Himself, the worshiper. So now I'm coming, and I've come into the doorway of the tent of meeting. I brought this animal without defect, male.
And I put my hand on its head to say, now I want it to take my place. And then now I slay the animal. What am I saying about myself? I give myself over completely to you. Now, typically they would take a knife, and very sharp, and they would slit the throat of the animal. The animal's going to die from two things in particular. What are they? Blood loss and asphyxiation, cannot breathe. And realize, here's this animal. What am I saying about my will? What am I doing with myself and what I'm doing to the animal? I am killing myself. Now, this is not a physical thing. This is the idea of what am I doing to my will and my desires? They're being slain. Now, you may think to yourself, I'm kind of squeamish. I don't like the idea of this stuff. Right. Because who's this offering to? Is this for us? No. What would that also say if you're a little squeamish on these things? What does it say about your desire to be accepted before God? I will give up the parts of me that even I'm not comfortable with. Is that the kind of statement that needs to be made to God? Yes. Then he says, he shall slay the young bull before the Lord, and Aaron's sons, the priests. Now, who takes over from here? The priests. You need someone to stand between, right? Do you remember who serves as high priest in the true tabernacle? Jesus. So now you see his part in the substance. He says, and Aaron's sons of priests shall offer up the blood and sprinkle the blood around on the altar that is at the doorway of the tent of meeting. So now it turns into the priests. They take the blood, they sprinkle it around on the altar of burnt offering, and they offer some up as well. And if you remember from Leviticus 17:11, it talks about that life is in the blood. So notice what is being given to God. I slay my own will and my own desires, and now I am offering my whole life to God. We kind of sing songs about this, don't we? Do we ever sing songs like, all to Jesus I surrender, all to him I freely give? You know what that song's really about? A burnt offering. We're saying to God, God, I give you all of me. We already share in the relationship with him, but now it's about dedication, complete whole dedication. Now, he continues on. Verse 6, he shall then skin the burnt offering and cut it into its pieces. Now, here's the priest. He skins, we'll probably use a term like field dress, but takes the skin off. Now, just in general, why take the skin off? You ever burned any hides? How's it smell? Putrid. It's a horrible smell. Is that what God wants his place of fellowship to smell like? No. And so the idea is, if you read it over in Leviticus 7:8, the priest that steps in to help, this is actually kind of his payment. He gets to keep the skin. Because does it have value whenever the skins are tanned and hide? And sure. So he's getting a benefit from this. Then it continues on. Verse 6, he says, and cut it into its pieces. Verse 7, the sons of Aaron the priest shall put fire on the altar and arrange wood on the fire. It says, here's fire, here's wood, because remember what burnt means. Put into smoke is the idea. Then, whole, complete. Verse 8, it says, and Aaron's sons, the priest, shall arrange the pieces, the head and the suet. Now, the suet is the hard fat around the kidneys and loins. They would use the suet for making things like candles and soaps and lubricants, if you look that up. He says, over the wood which is on the fire that is on the altar. And you think about the fat is being offered to God. Now, we have a different idea about fat in our culture. We say fat's probably the part that you don't want to eat. But fat was actually something, if you think about it, if you've ever grilled out food or smoked, the fat takes in all the flavor. And the fat was the highest portion. For them, we would say like the filet mignon is the best cut of meat. Most tender, juicy, depending on how it's cooked. And to go, that's what they would consider to be the fat, the best portion. So here when he talks about these portions, sometimes our culture kind of changes the way we think about it, but it's true from back here. Excuse me. He says, put them on the wood, on the fire that's on the altar, so they can be accepted. Verse 9. Its entrails, however, in other words, the guts, he says, and its legs he shall wash with water. He says, here's a washing. And notice water is an aspect of this. And the priest shall offer up in smoke, there's our burnt offering, how much of it? Everything that's put on the altar. Now we know it's not the skin, because that's given to the priest. But here he lays it out, all of it, on the altar for a burnt offering. He says, an offering by fire of a soothing aroma to the Lord. Soothing aroma. Now, I know for each and one of us, every one of us that are here, the aromas that are soothing are not all the same. Some people like vanilla, some people like lilac, some people like lavender, some people like chocolate, whatever. But who is this for? This is to the Lord. And what is he telling you? This is a soothing aroma to me. When you will kill off your own desires, your own will, and offer your life completely and totally to me, what does he find in that? A soothing and pleasing aroma. He says, that's how you do it. You ever wondered why God cares so much about heart when it comes to worship? Because what's he looking for? Mere words? No. Now, you see these things. Here's the shadow. I want you to think about the substance that's in Jesus. Think about this substance aspect. Whenever Jesus is baptized by John, Matthew chapter 3, and all of a sudden he comes up out of the water, and the clouds open up, and the Spirit descends in the form of a dove and remains upon him. You remember the words that God the Father says? This is my beloved Son in whom I am well pleased. Is Jesus a soothing aroma? From the time of his life of being born to this time about the age of 30, he's continued to grow in wisdom and in stature and in favor with God and man. Has he offered himself completely to God? Is God pleased with him? Yes. Another 3.5 years go by. He's on top of the Mount of Transfiguration. And all of a sudden, here he is with Peter, James, and John. Moses and Elijah show up. And all of a sudden, this overshadowing of a cloud comes over. And all of a sudden, God the Father speaks again. And what does he say now? This is my beloved Son in whom I am well pleased. Listen to him. In Jesus' ministry, has it been completely offered to God? Is it well pleasing to him? Has Jesus separated himself from doing his own will and his own desires to do the will of his Father? Is it pleasing to him? Is Jesus giving his life as a burnt offering to God? And is God pleased with him? Well pleased. Soothing aroma. Now, look over at John chapter 17. And we could spend hours on this. John chapter 17. Verse 16. says, they are not of the world, even as I am not of the world. Did Jesus keep himself from worldly thinking and worldly ways? Yes. He wasn't going after his own will. Notice the next verse, verse 17. He says, sanctify them in the truth. Your word is truth. What set Jesus apart from the world? The truth. What did he always speak? What did he always live? What was he always motivated by? Truth. No wonder in John 14:6, what does he call himself? I am the way, the truth, and the life. You know, why is he the life? Because he completely dedicated himself to truth. I'll do it God's way, not my own way. And was God well pleased in that? Yes. And Jesus set himself apart because of truth. Now, you can keep on going down the line about zeal for your house has consumed me. You think in terms of the quotations that come with Jesus about coming back to truth. Then look over to Ephesians chapter 5. Ephesians chapter 5, look at verse 2. Here's Jesus as this burnt offering to God. It says, and walk in love, just as Christ also loved you and gave himself up for us, an offering and a sacrifice to God as a fragrant aroma. Now, I'm going to tell you what we typically like to read into verse 2. We look at that, and what do we typically instantly think about? What events in the life of Jesus? We go to the cross. Is that really what this is about, though? This is about him giving his life completely and totally over to God. Sanctified in truth, walking in love. You tell me one story in all the gospel accounts where Jesus doesn't walk in love. You won't find one. You read through all 89 chapters of Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. You won't find one story where he steps outside of walking in love. Totally devoted to God. Now, he says, walk in love just as Christ also loved you and gave himself up for us. Because if he's not without defect, whenever he comes to be the sin offering, will it be accepted? It will not. So realize, he says, and a sacrifice to God. And here, notice the fragrant aroma. Fragrance. You want to know what gives off a great fragrance to God? When we imitate Jesus to walk in love and to walk in truth. This is who we've been called to be. Now, look at verse 1 in Ephesians chapter 5. He says, therefore be what? Imitators of God. He says, you need to focus on who Jesus is and imitate his dedication to God. He says, that is pleasing. When we give over our will, when we give over our desires, when we give our life to God. And notice, this was an offering for someone who already had fellowship with God. So who are we really talking about? Us. This is walking worthy of the calling. Now, real quickly before the bell rings again, look at Romans chapter 12. And like I said, we could talk about this much longer, but we're trying to be a little brief. Romans chapter 12, look at verse 1. Once again, offering ourselves as a burnt offering. We see that Jesus was this burnt offering, completely acceptable, well-pleasing to God, dedicated. What about us now, walking in love, walking in truth? He says, therefore I urge you, brethren, by the mercies of God. How did we come to this relationship? By God's mercies, not because of how good we were. He says, to present your bodies a living and holy sacrifice. We're alive to God. Are we going to have holy behavior? Is love holy behavior? Through and through. He says, because whenever you're the life that you're living is holy before God, what will you be also before God? Acceptable to God. Oh, we've come to Him. We've come to Jesus in this relationship. And now we can dedicate ourselves completely to God. He says, which is your spiritual service of worship. He says, this is a worship that is our daily worship. This is not the gathering together on Sundays. This is about our day-to-day life, just like with Jesus. Was He just holy to God on the Sabbath? No, every day. Verse 2. And do not be conformed to this world. Remember what Jesus said? He says, we're not of the world. And so I can't be conformed to the world and walk in love and truth. He says, do not be conformed to this world, but be transformed by the renewing of your mind. You got to change. We have to change the way we think, don't we? We can't be selfish, self-centered, self-serving. We've got to be selfless, loving, holy, truth. And now we offer to God our lives and we find acceptance and a soothing aroma. Real quickly, let's finish the verse. Transformed by the renewing of your mind so that you may prove, discover what the will of God is. Because if you walk together with Jesus as a whole, giving you whole to God, he says, what will you find before God? You'll discover His will. Did Jesus even have to discover God's will? He had to read it too, didn't he? And how did He respond? I'll do it. He says, that which is good and acceptable and perfect. So I hope you can see the burnt offering is about saying to God, God, I give you all of me. And that's exactly what Jesus did in all of His life. And this is what we're called to do in our lives now. Chuck. Right. Love never fails. If we dedicate ourselves to Him, it'll never fail. Lynn. Life. Right. She brings up 2 Corinthians chapter 2. One, like I said, these are scattered all over the New Testament. I wish we had time to go further, but all right. Have a good week.